You're listening to Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about content-first design with content strategist, Steph Hay. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is brought to you by Kraft. Kraft lets you create a content management experience that is perfectly tailored to your client's needs. Want to check it out? Just head over to demo.buildwithkraft.com and you can get your own demo site to fool around with in minutes.
Before we introduce our guest and get to today's episode, we want to once again remind our listeners to vote for us in the 2015 Net Awards.
Yay! Yeah, for the third time.
Yeah.
And thanks to your support. Not to mention the support of our sponsors and partners, we are up for Podcast of the Year.
And once again, we need sound effects.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was trying to do my best Oprah impression there.
Oh, is that what that was? All right, so voting is open until July, and we'll have the link in our show notes. So let's get to today's topic, which is content-first design. Our special guest is Steph Hay. Steph leads Capital One's content strategy team and also runs their weekly design sessions for 160 people across 10 locations. She's also a mentor at 1776 and 500 Startups. Welcome to the show, Steph.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So Steph, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Yes. Well, maybe I should start with the fact that this week, ladies, I am buying a house for the first time.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Awesome.
I'm looking
Congrats.
For a house. So are you already in the process of like they've accepted your offer and you're going to closing?
Okay. Yes. And
oh my
I should
gosh.
Say I as in we, my future husband who I've been with for 7 years, we've been looking for 5 years.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
And after obsessively watching HGTV in every hotel room I've ever been in because I don't have cable, I'm now in the throes of having gone through the inspection and I'm waiting to find out what they'll fix and not fix so that we can have an agreement and go toward closing, which will be July 15th if all goes well.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Well, good luck. I tell you what, I've been looking for just a month. We've been house hunting for about a month and it's incredibly stressful. I've already put in 2 offers and had those go. They didn't turn out. I have a third offer in right now and I'm not sleeping.
So you're waiting to hear back, right? This is the most tedious time for you then, right?
It's the worst because you want to like dream about what you're going to do because we're intending to get a fixer upper, but our offer hasn't been accepted. You know, we're in negotiations, I guess. So it's the more nebulous of the process. And then it gets to what you're at, the inspection stuff where it's also nebulous because you don't know what they're going to find and what you're right. going to have to eat or what. This is not fun. I know it's going to pay off in the end, but I don't like it myself.
That's right. We were looking out over 3 weeks. And if it goes well, then we're going to be very happy. And if it falls through, we're still going to be very happy, but it'll be another house someday. But so far, it's been a pretty exciting week.
Oh, wow. That's really exciting. Oh, well, I'm excited for you.
Thank you.
So are you buying in Virginia?
Yes. Falls Church.
Oh, wow. That's right near where I was born, grew up.
Where were you born?
Alexandria.
Okay, so that's where I live now.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And I have lived for the last 12 years.
Yeah, I grew up on Van Dorn and Franconia, the corner of that, and the townhouse is there.
You are kidding me.
Nope.
I live in Franconia.
Do you really? What a small world.
Okay, I live at the corner of, well, it doesn't matter. Like, who's going to listen to this? I don't want to tell anybody where I'm living. Anyway, we'll talk about that after this podcast.
That sounds good. So let's talk a little bit about content strategy. I mean, is that what you, I mean, that's your job title is content strategist. So like, what is content strategy?
It's different depending upon where you are. So I'm going to give you the answer of where we are here at Capital One, which I joined last September after 5 years on my own as an independent.
Oh, wow. What made you make that decision?
It was too good to pass up to be part of something that's so cool is this. I've been able to start a team focused on the kind of content strategy I get really excited about, which is designing products with content. Mm-hmm. And that's experiences too. And the kinds of conversations that we want to have with people through the interface and actually thinking about the kinds of conversations we want them to have about us with their friends and family, you know, when they're standing there on the street showing you, hey, check out what Capital One just did. Mm-hmm. I want to be part of forming that conversation. So for us, content strategy is designing experiences that feel like personalized conversations, and we do that using words.
It sounds like it's about connecting.
That's exactly right. And especially in a regulated industry, the challenge was too great where you don't think about your bank as your best friend.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
You don't necessarily even trust that your bank is giving you all of the information that you need. In fact, there are some articles. There was one that came out a couple weeks ago from TechCrunch where the author said, the reason we're trusting the simples of the world, you know, is because they speak our language. And that's a clear opportunity for someone like me and my team of nine folks who are really interested in speaking the language of our customers to take advantage of. If our company is brave enough to use that same language, which Capital One is, and that's why I'm here, then we've got a real opportunity to make the kinds of experiences that I haven't in my career had an opportunity to make at this scale. And it's such an incredibly emotional intersection of people and their money.
Yeah, with banking. I mean, you want to feel comfortable with your bank on a whole bunch of different levels, some of which are human and some of which are monetary and trust-based, and you want them to be, you know, serious, but you also, it's got to be a very difficult line to walk.
Approachable, but serious.
Serious.
Yeah.
That's right. And what you are actually doing right now is thinking about things in the way that, you know, we as a content strategy team within the larger design organization, we're actually within the product design team. That's the way we're thinking about it, which is it's very contextually specific how we are going to talk to you, because we have to know who you are, what kind of language you use, what you're trying to do, how long you've been a customer with us, and on. I mean, the variables are almost endless to be able to design the kind of conversation that will feel like we have anticipated you and are responding to you and know you.
And it sounds super client-focused, but I guess it also has to be, the goals have to ultimately tie back to Capital One.
Exactly.
You got to make those people happy too.
Right. So you're talking about the balance between being customer focused and still having to run a business.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah.
Luckily, the company, I mean, this is the big opportunity of why I decided to join. I mean, I was definitely not looking for a job, and that's another story I suppose we could get to, but the DNA at Capital One in particular is to be customer first, to really apply design thinking methodologies that are empathy-driven methods to our design process, to our product development process. So we start with the needs of the person, and then we say, okay, this is what people need. How does this map to the business versus this is what the business needs. How do we find people to take advantage of that? You know, how do we sell to them?
That reminds me of, I don't know if you're at all familiar with Whitney Hess, but we had her on the show last year talking just about that bringing humanity back to the business, which is focusing on what the customer, your audience wants and needs, and having your business respond to that rather than the other way around.
Exactly. And funny that you say that too, because bringing humanity to the language of banking is what our charge is. Like, that's what we are here to do at the company.
So how does that entire, like, well, human first, customer focused decision making fit into content first and content first design? Like, how does that even work?
Yeah, so a couple ways in particular. We're really lucky enough to have daily testing sessions for a whole variety of different things that we're prototyping or planning to release to market, different stages of their development process. So in testing on a daily basis, from a content perspective, we'll have a content strategist who's sitting in these empathy interviews with customers or with people who might not be customers yet, but might be interested in being customers. We'll have a content strategist sit and listen to how people talk about the problems that they have with any sort of money-related issue at all. And most of the time, by the way, it's not even about the money. The money is the enabler. It's about their lives, right? So a woman whose husband just died and he had been managing the finances for their entire lives. Somebody who has got a kid in college who's about ready to graduate and she wants her kid to have a credit card and learn how to start using credit wisely. This is the kind of daily conversation that people across the company are having with real people. And a content strategist can sit and listen in on those and will be exclusively focused on the language that people use to talk about the problems that they have or the goals that they have in their lives. Because without that laser focus, without that specialty, what happens, as we all know when we're focused on a whole lot of things, is that we end up inadvertently moving to overly formal language or passive language. We start to categorize things because that's what humans do by nature, is to say, well, this person kept using the word money, but we're going to use the word funds instead. Mm-hmm. And suddenly now we've just added a layer between us and the reality of the language that people use to talk about their lives, and in particular in relation to money. And so our team can sit in those interview sessions on a daily basis and keep teams real, can keep teams real with their language that they're putting in the interface, with the language they're using with each other when they're talking about design, so that as an entire company, we start speaking the language of our customers mm-hmm. rather than adding formality to it. So that's one of the ways that we're working. And for the end-to-end experiences that are already out there, we'll say, what is the person trying to accomplish when he or she signs in? Knowing what we know about this particular customer, if we walk from end to end and we try to read out loud all of the things that we put in front of this person, does it sound like a conversation, A, we want to be in, B, they want to be in with us, you know, and C, the kind of conversation that is really going to connect with them, that really helps them get done with what they need to get done and shows them that we're a partner to them. And if the answer is no, we can do better. So our team really tries to separate design and layout and channel and all of the things that are structure related that often conflate whether or not we're actually connecting to the person in language by coaching the designers and the product leads and the business analysts to thinking about all of the experiences as conversations.
And is that something that you said that a content strategist can sit in on these sessions? Mm-hmm. Does that involvement of sort of guiding and keeping the team focused on that realness, the right language, mm-hmm. that sort of, is it throughout everything, or is it just sort of in the beginning as you're gathering, you know, the keywords, the language?
Right.
But does it go into when the developer's writing code, or if there happens to be some sort of back end development or the QA? Like, where does content strategy sort of begin and end in the whole process?
Mm-hmm. No, great question. I have a slide actually when I'm talking about this with different teams who are new to content strategy. And I'm really proud of this animation because I'm a content person. I'm not a designer, but in Keynote, I have a slide that says all the dang time. And it animates by shaking. And I'm really proud of the animation. That's when content strategy fits in all the dang time. So in the beginning, it becomes really imperative to get everybody speaking the same language so that we can work better as a team and so that it manifests itself into the interfaces or mechanisms through which we're communicating to customers. And it doesn't ever get to the point where the designer is thinking, okay, we should put a headline here. Now, is there a copyrighted or fill in the blanks? Because the designer had been working with a content strategist right from the very beginning to understand that if you think a headline should go there, without thinking about what it should actually say. Mm-hmm. That's actually structure over content. And so it's shifting the mindset to say, okay, designer, you're designing this interface. What is the conversation that should be here? So that they're actually thinking content first along the way. If they set that precedent, what ends up happening is a really great trickle-down effect through the development process where suddenly the developer who's always had a bad rep because, for example, an error message that doesn't have any language attached to it, he or she has to fill it in so the thing will ship. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly the content strategist or the designers or whomever says, wait, how did this get out to production? Because this isn't the kind of language we want to use. And it's like, well, yeah, because nobody wrote it for this person. Nobody, you know, this person was disconnected from the design process. This was an afterthought. This was a fill in the blank. So it's not a surprise that that's how it reads. So if everybody is part of the design process up front, and that includes the developers to be part of those initial interviews, to hear the language that people are speaking, to understand what the conversation is going to be, that reflects itself through the design process, through the interactions, so that A, more error messages can be prevented. Like, we can actually prevent them because we know how the conversation is going to go. We don't design the interface first and say, oh, somebody could get in this dead end here. We got to put an error message. We just design so that there's no dead end. And then secondarily, when we do have those sorts of error messages, there's already a tone established as part of the application that feels like natural human language. And so nobody's trying to meet some expectation of formality. They're just writing the language that meets for that particular use case.
So all of this that you're telling me, it just sounds amazing and great and ideal. Okay, it sounds ideal. But I'm sure most of our listeners will say their team or their situation or their company or whatever, they don't have quite maybe the buy-in or the knowledge to know how to go through a content first strategy, content strategy. So how would you introduce something like this in that type of context?
I know it sounds idealistic to say, if you can write an email, you can do content first design, but it is true. I think what surprises people is that doing content first design doesn't require, you know, copywriting or a journalism degree. It requires a bravery on behalf of whomever is doing it to be willing to be boring. I mean, that's the most, like, real is boring, man. I mean, real is raw and honest and transparent. And a lot of times it doesn't sound flashy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make promises it can't keep. It just is what it is. And that's actually what builds trust. When you say you're going to do something and then you do it, mm-hmm. you actually exceed expectations because so few people do that. So few people are willing to say what it is that you are going to get in reality. They want to make it sound a little better so that you're intrigued, so you come in, or they want to make some promises, and everything promises to be quicker, faster, easier than ever before, more awesome. And rarely it is. So you're already working against two things. One is that a general population feels disillusioned by the promises that they're made all the time. The second thing is, anyway, that sets an expectations on the people designing these experiences that they have to come up with the right language to really, like, engage someone. If you know who you're talking to and you have a real conversation right away, that is the most engaging, most trust-building way to have a conversation with someone. So content-first design means primarily being willing to speak the language that is required of building trust with somebody, which is very real, boring language for the most part. And it doesn't mean it can't have a sense of humor. It doesn't mean that it can't have a personality. It just means removing a lot of the pressure we put on ourselves to make something sound a certain way. If we can get there, what ends up happening is you don't feel like you have to sell the idea. You just do the work. You say, what are we trying to do here? If we had to design this entire experience in a Google Doc, how would it go? What is the conversation? How would it start? Where would it go? What if-then statements do we run into along the way? Let's start designing almost like a choose-your-own-adventure book, where we just stick to the words, because everyone, no matter who, what your specialty is, everyone can read and participate in that level of a discussion. Words are our common denominator. Language and communication in that way is our common denominator. Only when we have actually all arrived that this is actually what we're trying to design, this is the kind of conversation we want to have with somebody, this is where we would want to lead them if they showed us this degree of interest, then we can actually move to structure and channel and visual, the sorts of stuff that will bring that conversation to life. So I want to be clear, though, that we've started this journey 9 months ago in Capital One, an organization of more than 40,000 people, on a design team of 140 within a larger digital organization that has products and different product owners and different priorities. So it isn't flick the switch on and go. It is a constant learning curve for everyone, including us, about how we can jump into the middle of a process and start to change the focus away from what are the new features that we can add here to what is the conversation mm-hmm. that we're already having with people based on this existing experience. Who would want the feature? How would we talk about this? When would we show it to them? To move it more toward, from a UX perspective, contextual relevance conversation versus just a let's build it because we can conversation.
So you guys have been doing this, you mentioned, I think, for about 9 months. Do you know, was this shift towards this direction prompted by anything? It just seems to me, having worked in really large organizations, that it can be difficult to have, this sounds kind of like non-traditional marketing. And it's just, to me, not the marketing that I've, the teams that I've worked in. Because it's all about, you know, someone says X, Y needs to be done. The marketing people are like, oh, yeah, yeah, we'll get it done. And they write some copy and blah, blah, blah. Not once have we considered the audience that we're trying to connect with. It's just, you know, crank out materials, crank out things, prepare these, you know, advertisements and such. And that's a huge shift. I mean, that's how marketing has traditionally been done, at least in my experience, especially mm-hmm. in these really big organizations. So Do you know why that shift sort of occurred, or, you know, how you could kind of encourage that same mental shift within maybe, you know, our listeners? It may be within their employer's environment or with a client that they're working with.
Yeah. Speed. That's why this shift is happening. Speed to market. To be competitive as a large organization, we cannot afford to optimize for a waterfall production environment when it comes to experience design. I mean, experience is brand. Experience is marketing. Experience is our product. Mm-hmm. It's all interrelated. And with the speed at which so many companies have been able to get to market using open source, using APIs, to create billion-dollar companies that have disrupted in huge industries, like, you know, this is the Ubers and the Airbnbs of the world, right? Mm-hmm. This is impossible to ignore. It is to the peril of companies that choose to, who think, I'll just reduce my risk by making this linear process even more linear. This can't happen. There has to be a self-organization around great ideas that is focused on validating that you're on the right track at every stage.
Mm-hmm.
Only by setting up those market forces, those even in a big company that already has scale and infrastructure, if you set up the right conditions to mimic those market forces, that's how innovation happens. And so we were really lucky, content strategy team, that a few years ago, Evelyn Huang out of Stanford D School joined Capital One to establish a design thinking practice within the design team to start orienting the various stakeholders around the company toward the idea of, you know, needs of people first design, right? Let's start with the needs of people, iterate quickly, validate ideas, prototype, 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 release to market, test and learn, go. And we come in and say, okay, needs of people on one side, needs of the business on the other, almost like a Venn diagram, the overlap is growth. Well, the way people talk about their needs and the way we as a business talk about those same needs, if we use the same language, the overlap there is faster growth because we'll have the right conversation right from the get-go. So it's a combination of the company recognizing that to compete, we have to be a software company. We can't be a bank. And combine that with investment, huge investment in APIs and in the design thinking practice and a content strategy and a whole bunch of other, you know, forward-leaning techniques and methods and technologies that we've been able to get to this point where the company understands experience design and the needs of experience design. We're not there yet, but we're on our way.
Well, the thing I'm concerned about, I mean, it sounds excellent and great. And then you mentioned that speed is one of the driving forces of content-first design and a less of a linear approach. But I feel like some hesitation is that content-first design actually will introduce more time as opposed to speed. Especially, you know, we're in the client services here where we do work with small businesses. In our experience, sometimes the delay is due to the client dragging on getting the content addressed. You know, like, for example, like, I can design, basically, once I get the direction and the content, I can design and get it done. But until I get that content, nothing happens. So how do you make that efficient? How do you make content-first design not delay anything? And what happens if the client or whoever it is on your team or in your company holds something up in terms of content?
Now you're talking to the content strategist here.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've always been on the receiving end of designs that don't support the content because of that exact reason. Let's design a design. Let's structure a design. And then let's plug in the content.
Yeah.
Right.
Same thing with a CMS. Let's design a content management system. Let's architect the whole thing. And then let's try to actually put data in it.
Right.
So this doesn't work. This, as you just said, holds up launches even. And then when it launches, man, have I worked with a ton of designers who are disappointed at what they ended up spending the last several months creating because the fanfare of what it could have been never reached that epic level because of the content.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's very easy to get distracted by the shiny new. So if you forward, if you push forward the biggest challenge, which is the content. What are we actually trying to say? How are we going to say it? and the client never gets you content, what's the problem? What do they really want? Do they want a design? Because if they want a design, redesign and just use their existing content. Then if they want a better website, if they want a better experience, if they want a better product, they have to work in tandem. And the subject matter expert, the person who knows the customer on the other side of the interface, the person who knows their business, that person has to be brought into the fold early in the process. And so I'm going to use an example of when I was consulting, working on a Ben and Jerry's website redesign. This is a company now running independently within Unilever, been acquired by Unilever. So I have a lot of different people at the table who have a lot of different requirements for what the Ben and Jerry's brand and what their new website should be. And I was working with the really fine folks at Happy Cog on this as a subcontractor. So there were a lot of people in the room. How can we all talk about what this should be? Well, traditionally what we would do is say, what do you want the new website to have? And we go through a laundry list of features. And we said, okay, let's get into Google Doc. And I'm going to lead a little content workshop here during the kickoff meeting that goes something like this. Hey, everybody around the table, tell me what the top three questions that your customers ask are. Tell me what the top three things that they complain about are. Mm. Now, already, the IT person, the PR person, the marketing person, the product person, they're all going to have different answers. But they're about the content that represents the opportunity we have to actually communicate with the person across the other side of the interface in a better way. And then I'll say, okay, now tell me what your answers to their questions are, or tell me how you resolve their complaints. And again, now we're starting to show that, hey, people are calling in with this question a lot, and we actually don't give them an answer. There's nowhere to find it, or it's buried in the website. Well, geez, wouldn't it cut down on a lot of call volume if we actually made that a more prominent part of the conversation? Yes, great. So now we already have hierarchy happening. And so if we spend our time early on focused on getting the content, even if it's just happening around kickoff meetings, put in a Word document, put in a Google document that everybody can contribute to. What naturally happens is a structure starts to emerge just out of the hierarchy of the conversation. And then the designer can start to see, okay, this is the kind of conversation we're supposed to be designing for. So he or she can actually move much more quickly. Even when it comes to something like an interaction versus just like a standard marketing website. And again, I'll use the Ben & Jerry's example. Why did people come to Ben & Jerry's? Well, it's because they're looking for a flavor. And not just the flavor, but where they can buy the flavor. So what could we give them? Well, in a Google Doc, we said, well, we could give them a whole laundry list of all of the different flavors. They could choose a flavor. Then we could show them where the local scoop shop was if they wanted to go get it in person. Or we could show them where they could get it, their local grocer, the CVS down the street. Now, most of the time you might stop there and go, great, we know what we need. Go ahead and design it. Mm-hmm. But what does it actually mean to say this CVS? Well, this CVS has got to have an address. The CVS might need to have a phone number. Maybe we should show hours of operation. We start thinking about those things before there's ever a layout, before there's ever design. We put all of those things that could be the content. Somebody needs to make a decision, in this case, to find a flavor, before we ever get to design. And now everybody's participating in that Google Doc in the first couple weeks of a project. So we're able to say, well, we know where you're located because you're using your phone, you're using your logging on from your computer. At home, we know where you're located. Let's make an assumption about what that is, show you the nearest one. All of that stuff is captured. Now we've got requirements. We've got requirements starting to come from the content. And so by the time we actually, and if you go to the Ben & Jerry's website, you'll see at the very, very top of the page, because this was the number one reason why people were coming, so it should be the most prominent, the very top of the page on the Ben & Jerry's website, you immediately see a flavor finder. And that whole little widget, that whole little interactive experience was designed in a Google Doc in the first 2 weeks of the project.
I like what you're describing here because I can see it scaling down. I mean, Leo, what comes to my mind is when we have those early kickoff meetings, we ask questions like, what are your visitor goals? What are your audience goals? And what if we just shifted that slightly and we're like, what are the questions your customers are asking you regularly? You know, how do you answer? Like just those two little shifts also.
That's right.
You know, I really could see it scaling because we're already asking some of these questions. It's just like the phrasing and what we're actually trying to get. You know, if we realize that we're actually not trying to get the business owner's idea of what their audience wants, we want the business owner to tell us what their audience is already doing with them.
That's exactly right. And what you'll notice too immediately if you try this, the business owner is able to answer that question very quickly. There's mm-hmm. probably a few emails in his or her inbox or voicemail messages about this, right? It's probably the thing that is costing them operationally. They can speak to this because this is their customer feedback loop. And so we're often so focused, again, on the structure and on the design and on the thing we're making mm-hmm. that we forget that there's actually a person on the other side. And at the end of the day, if none of this existed, if there was not a digital tool and there was just me and a phone, or even better yet, me in a room with another person, that I should still be able to make a sale. Mm-hmm. I should still be able to have a conversation there. So it's trying to strip it back down to what is fundamentally connecting us in the first place, which is the language that we use with each other.
Yeah, I definitely can see that, because even just shifting the word visitor to, so what do your customers...
That's right.
Right? It's... You know, in the web world, it's the same thing, but in the context of who actually is visiting and what your client understands, mm-hmm. you know, customer makes way more sense.
That's right. And, you know, we've actually, that's one of the shifts that we've made here internally, too. When we're doing our interviews, we actually ask people early on, you know, we might, as anybody would at any company doing usability testing, show them a prototype or show them a design. And then... see if they can use it. I mean, that is usability testing, right? There's something different here that's often conflated with usability testing, where a red flag for me will be when the designer comes and says, hey, people aren't understanding this. I think we need to rewrite it. Or we need to educate people and we need to put a learn more screen. You know, they don't know, because this is part of the design process, right? This is the evolution. But they don't realize that the opportunity to get somebody to understand something has probably already passed. If they don't understand, if they can use it and it's usable, that's great. Understandability is totally different. And I even divide that further to be like understandable, the point of making confident decisions, versus understandable, where we can sometimes fixate to say, you know, well, this person didn't understand that what this word meant exactly. But did the person understand it enough to be able to make a decision confidently? If the answer is yes, let's just keep moving then.
Mm-hmm.
So understandability becomes a key component of a process that's a content-first process, because we're focused on getting at the core truth of whatever it is that's bringing us to this interaction in the first place, to make sure that we understand each other. And so what our usability testing labs has done, since they've started adopting some content-first principles, is say, before we even show them a prototype, we're going to ask people to design the kind of conversation they want to be in with us. So we will know in the back of our minds what we've already designed, but we won't show it to them yet. We'll say, hey, if you ever had an experience, you know, if you ever had a bad experience at an ATM, tell us about that, you know, and then they'll talk about it. We'll say, well, what would you rather have had the ATM say to you? And man, do they take off. They love telling us exactly what they would have rather that conversation been. And if we're only brave enough to listen to it, we have just let our customers design the ideal experience. And so we can draw from that and say, cool, now that they've just designed that back and forth interaction, how does that line up or not line up with what we thought the interaction should be? How should we revise our interaction so that it actually ends up being much more understandable from the get-go?
So with regard to that understandability, I'm curious, does storytelling make things more understandable for people?
Absolutely. It's more trustworthy. It's more fun. I mean, actually, Jared Spool once gave me some really great advice about storytelling. He said, listen to the first 10 seconds of any This American Life episode. What happens is Ira Glass, if you're familiar with it, the host, will just immediately launch into a story. He'll say something like, Mary Smith, one day, went to her mailbox and couldn't believe what she opened, you know? And everybody's listening. You're listening because he's already in a story.
Mm-hmm.
So you pay attention to that. You know, I mean, I ask this question often when, if I hear this in meetings where, well, we need to educate the customer, I'll say, like, how many of you love being educated by companies?
Yeah.
So that's a real opportunity to figure out what the real story is and to be able to tell the story. And that's why even starting those interviews that we have with customers by saying, tell us a story about, or tell us about a time when, gets them in the storytelling frame of mind so that we can listen to the language that they use and the watch their behavior change once there's an emotional trigger. You can see their body change. You can see them lean forward when they're really uncomfortable about that story or when they're really excited about something. And we pay really close attention to those. So storytelling is, it's an often used phrase, in, especially in the marketing world, right? But it is and has been for centuries the very best way to convey information and connect people together. I mean, think about the beginning of our podcast when I started telling you about my home buying experience.
Right.
I mean, you guys are basically my best friends already.
Well, I mean, that's all great, but obviously not all stories work out and not all interpretations of these conversations are correct. How do you track whether or not your interpretation of these interactions and listening to your customers are successful? And if it isn't, what do you do?
Perfect question. It's all the level of specificity required to name a measurement. It's so great. We have to be able to be specific about what we're trying to measure in order to see whether or not it's actually made a difference. And so there are the sort of, if you're at all familiar with, you know, the lean methodologies, there's this sort of vanity metrics of, you know, if we're doing marketing storytelling, that might be, you know, increased time on site or, you know, more pages per visit or something along those lines, right? Where we can at least get some baseline indicators about whether or not people are interested in this compared to our average. And the ideal would be that they would go up. And at some point, I'm sure there's a law of diminishing returns. More fundamentally, from an experience perspective and from a business perspective, we would want to know what operational costs or sales targets we could use as measures to say, look, we put these things into the market at this schedule for these kinds of people. And then we came back 2 and 3 and 4 months later and we saw a decrease in call volume on these topics that we actually wrote about. And that might actually include telling stories of people who had really terrible experiences, maybe with our products, maybe in their lives, completely agnostic of our products, but to get a little real about some of the ugly underbelly of the financial industry, not necessarily us, but potentially us. What have we done in the past or what were we overlooking in the past that really didn't serve our customer in the way that we want to serve a customer? And then to be able to say, but look, because of this, we made all these changes and now we're trying to do right. We're trying to be better. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of power in that too. So being able to measure whether or not some content that we put into the world, some stories that we put into the world made any measurable difference means saying this has to be on this time, you know, 3 months from now, we're going to come back and look at call volume or email volume. And we're going to try and decrease the number of calls about this topic like login. And we're going to try and increase the number of calls about something like credit card application or something like that. And we have to be specific about the tests that we're putting in the market too. We can't just say we're publishing a bunch of content hoping that it works. Mm-hmm. We have to use data, you know, Google keyword data or site search data or data from groups around the company right now who've already been doing some storytelling and say, what does it seem to be that our customers really want from us? What's the language they're using? What are the problems that they have in their lives that we actually might be able to help them with? And so it's on both sides, the using some data, using some hypotheses up front to create the stories, and then knowing what we're measuring them against. So it doesn't just end up being a production cycle that we're sort of watching vanity metrics endlessly about.
Yeah, it makes me think of, we had a client ask us at the beginning of the project, how will I know if I'm successful? Well, what is success to you? Like, you know, what is it that you're trying to measure? You know, you have to know what that is in the beginning. Success isn't, like you just the, you know, the Google Analytics numbers look better.
That's right. And it's not a maintenance plan, especially having worked in agencies for a long time, right? It's not just a maintenance plan. It's iteration. It is saying these 3 months, we're going to try and move the needle on these two measures. And here's how we're going to do it. And then putting it into the world and seeing if you do it or not. And being brave enough to say, well, that didn't work. And now we've learned this about it. So let's iterate on how we're doing it and try again.
So how does that iteration work? Like, how do you help your employer? How could we help our customers, our clients, adjust when something isn't working?
Well, it's all about the specificity and the time frame that you're willing to stay the course with the test. And it's entirely dependent upon your scale. So somebody, you know, like a Capital One, where we've got millions of data points at any moment, you know, within an hour, we can put tests in the market and know by the end of the day what's working and not working, as long as we've said this is the metric that we're looking at. This is what we're paying attention to. For others, I've worked in most of my career that on sites that didn't have this scale, on companies that didn't have this scale. And so it might take a month or two or three to actually see measurable results. And the hard part about those is just the nervousness around that time. Is that being time lost? But to really know that you are putting forth the effort to measure and staying true to time frame is what's necessary to get them comfortable with being able to answer the question, is this working or not working? Your job and my job and is exactly the same, is to require that level of specificity to say, why are we doing this? What are the data points we're using to make these decisions in the first place? It might be business objectives. You know, we say, okay, well, these are the three key business objectives. What is some data that we have at our disposal? And in a content perspective, that's like, you know, keyword data or site search data or something like that. What are some of the data points that we can use right now to make informed decisions about where to start? And then operationally, what are we measuring against? And our job, you know, is to define those so that we know why the heck we're doing anything we're doing in the first place.
When you're looking at something, especially with what you were just saying, that sometimes it does take some time to allow the data to come in and then evaluate. So as a site evolves, how do you make sure that content first, that approach is still a priority? Especially, you know, we often, Leigh and I, we'll launch with a client and everyone's happy for a period of time. And, you know, we're touching base, but nothing's really ongoing. But then some need comes up a couple months down the road and we're all not still in that same mindset that we were with the original project. So, you know, to keep content first part of it, like how do you bring in new stuff and ensure that that's still a priority?
There are a couple tactical things that we do. One is that when somebody requests anything, whether it's, you know, for a recently relaunched site or some new idea that just came out of the blue, to say, could you put down two paragraphs or three paragraphs about the end state here? If somebody, if a reporter was writing about this after it launched or after it went live, what would the reporter say about it? Now, this is a really interesting exercise because the people who have strong vision love doing it. And the people who just want to build it for the sake of building it and maybe aren't sure how to do it will hate this. And so if you're in a position to say like, well, look, this is just going to be some work. This is going to be some work to pay the bills and there's not really an outcome here. It sort of helps you immediately say whether or not you should worry about trying to measure it versus just doing it because somebody's asking you to do it. And that's the first thing. Can you give me, you know, the end state, two or three paragraphs about what this would look like if a reporter was writing about it? And the other thing that we would do is, and this is something that I've worked on a bunch, to be able to say, hey, okay, this sounds great. I love this idea. What are the measurements that we're going to put in place to see whether or not this is working? And so some of those things might be like the trigger of who are we showing this to? If there's any ability to show it variably to different kinds of people, who are the people we're showing this to? If they say, well, it's a subset of their customers, well, then that immediately helps you understand where it might fit into the architecture or how it could be messaged to somebody. For example, maybe this should just go out to an email. Maybe you should actually have a form on your site that actually has the ability for people to self-identify themselves as part of a certain group if there isn't one already. The point is, by asking them, like, what's the trigger? Like, when would we actually show this to people? It gets the person who's requesting it to think about their audience.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, it would work for this kind of person. Okay, cool. When would we show it? Where would we show it? Why would we show it? These are the sorts of questions that immediately follow. Once you have all of that information, you already have the content that you need. You already have exactly what you need to design from there or to ideally have a few paragraphs or a content prototype that outlines exactly what it is that this person wants and why they want it and for whom. So it kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier, where it's almost like that little mini kickoff again. Mm-hmm. You get them focused on, like, what do you want people to be saying about this? Or what is the conversation we should be having with people?
I was just going to say that what I really like about what you're describing, and, you know, I came into this episode not really knowing what to expect because I have no formal experience with content strategy. But the stuff you're describing, I feel that even Leigh and I could start doing some of it. You know, just like I was describing, just being more specific, asking. Mm-hmm. It's up to us to be more specific with our clients to get the most information we can from them. You know, we don't necessarily write their copy. You know, we don't always have a project that they're willing to bring in a copywriter or things like that. And I think I thought content strategy was copywriting on some level.
Sure.
And so this is making me realize that that really isn't what it has to do with anything. It's for me and Leigh, where this is relevant is in that discovery phase where we're really trying to be specific with the client. And then also during development and launch, making sure we're still being specific when they're asking us to, they always ask us to add something extra that was never listed in the beginning, mm-hmm. and, you know, how we're going to evaluate the quote unquote success of the site, you know, knowing what those specifics are before we even build it. You know, this isn't some like concept out there that you have to like grasp at. Like, you can just, as a business owner, as the project manager, just change your approach in the very beginning with the questions you ask and the answers you expect.
That's exactly right. And I am now officially hiring you to be my PR representative at absolutely everything. No, it's really true. And honestly, copywriting often starts the conversation with us, and I'm welcome to it. Many of us who are content strategists got into content strategy because we love language, because we love the words, we love copywriting, we love everything about the content. The reality is there is a content strategy field thanks to pioneers like Christina Halvorsen who formalized it. And now what's happening is we're defining the aspects of content strategy that work for us as individuals into smaller niche groups. Like, UX content strategy is a term here. That's the title of the jobs that I'm hiring for my team. We are UX content strategists. We think about design and product as the experience and the communication that's involved in that as all one thing, rather than thinking about them as pieces of real estate. Mm-hmm. And when we think about it in that way, we all bring our various passions to the table. Business is at the table, and technology is at the table, and visual design and interaction design, UX design and content, we're all at the table. But they're all so interrelated that if any of us start getting into the conversations that I think are just no longer relevant in the world today, which is like, hey, can you just push this here and move this over here? You know, we end up having discussions about what we're trying to communicate with the person on the other side of the interface rather than trying to tell them how to do it, mm-hmm. how to structure it. And by doing that, we end up all learning how to do it better together. We become better designers. The designers and product people become more comfortable with writing consumer-facing or customer-facing content, which is what it's all about. It's not about specialty. It's about just getting real about what it is that somebody actually needs and then designing an experience together to meet that need. So you're exactly right that doing content-first design means being brave enough to stay as far away from the things that start to conflate the discussions with people until you guys know you're all on the same page for sure. And what better way to start doing the work than to start doing the work?
Wow, this is a really great conversation. So before we wrap up, we do have a couple of final questions. What do you think makes a great content strategist?
Someone who is incredibly focused on finding the language that connects people. Someone who is not attached at all to writing a thing that sounds a certain way. Someone who is not territorial of the language because he or she knows that it's really the customer is the person who needs to own the language. And we're just the people who need to put the words in the right place so that they know we're here for them, so that we're communicating with them. Content strategist is the kind of person who's enthusiastic about finding better ways to communicate with people.
And finally, what are your top resources for getting familiar with content-first design?
Or content strategy?
You know, the leaders of the industry, the Christina Halvorsen and the Karen McGrains, and I love the stuff that Kate Keeper Lee, Nicole Fenton have written on Nicely Said out of their experiences in MailChimp. These are a few places I would start. Some of the work that I've done in content first design on UIE.com, there are a couple of podcasts and virtual seminars there I would point people to. But generally speaking, I think it's such an emerging field to think about content-first design almost like, you know, script writing was for Hollywood or video game design is. This is the sort of stuff that is emerging in our field. And so I'm psyched to be on one of the pioneers of this as a concept and as a methodology here at Capital One. So maybe follow Capital One and some of the things that we're doing.
Cool. You know, and it just occurred to me when you mentioned, you know, it's like how people are writing scripts for Hollywood or how video game designers are crafting those experiences. I wonder if, you know, more and more of those sorts of trades and skill sets will come into our field because they just seem to be such a natural fit as our field's evolving.
That's right. And almost they have to because they set the precedent of what you would expect from an interface. You know, video games are 20 years ahead of us. Mm-hmm. And the creativity and the level of design that goes into their story telling. It's not by accident. It's because it increases engagement and retention, and that's the entire business of the video game industry. The more you play a game, the more you invite other people to play a game, that's how they grow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love this. I really do. I love it because I feel like it's something that anyone can do. I mean, and I don't mean that in a way like, oh, it's so easy. Anyone can do it. I just mean anybody could take this time to kind of focus themselves in a little different way with their projects and how they communicate and define success. So I that's what's really appealing to me. I feel like it's empowering.
That's right. I feel the same way. I'm glad to hear it. Thank you.
And I think you used the right language.
Exactly. Nicely done. Content strategist already.
So before we finish up, we have our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better.
Cool.
You ready, Steph?
I'm ready.
Okay. Question one, Android or iOS?
Android.
If you were stranded on a desert island and can only bring three things, what would you bring?
A giant umbrella, chapstick, an endless supply of fresh water. How boring is that? But that's true.
Survival.
That's right.
What's your favorite TV show?
Game of Thrones right now.
Nice.
What's your favorite dessert?
Oh, tres leches cake. Holy cow. Especially from Mama Zoo's in, anyway, doesn't matter. It's amazing. In Richmond. It's amazing.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I would love to be an architect.
What profession would you not like to try?
I would hate to be a garbage man or woman.
What's the latest article or blog post you've read?
That's a great question. I just read this really great post from a Google designer about how Google has transitioned to be a design-led organization.
Mm. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Flying, for sure.
What music do you like to work to?
Classical, WETA here in Washington, D.C.
And last question, cats or dogs?
Cats. I've got one. She's 7. Her name's Sneakers.
Aww.
We're cat people here. This is a cat show. So,
do you find as a cat person, by the way, like I do sometimes when people ask that question, I feel like I should say dog. Like, oh, geez, here we go. I'm going to say cat. And they're going to be like, I don't like cats. And I'm going to say, you must not have a heart then. But
I have no shame in my cat-loving game.
Good.
Cat-loving game. That's awesome.
I'm going to have a fourth cat soon. So there's definitely game in that. It's crazy.
All right. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us, Steph.
Thanks for having me.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Steph, STEPH underscore Hey, HAY.
Thanks again. This was a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I loved it.
We'd now like to thank our sponsor for this podcast, Pixel and Tonics Craft.
And thanks to our partners, Arcus Tech, DevOT, and EE Insider.
We also want to thank our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we continue our exploration of the Craft CMS with a deeper dive into its Twig templating language with Andrew Welch. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.